Kira inquired.
A robot we send out for a specific task, Daphne explained. The maintenance robots do the same thing all the time, day after day, but often we need to handle something more precise. The biologists want a soil sample, so we send out a drone with a drill. Or the geologists want to map a specific crater, so we send out a flying drone to scan it. The thing is, not just anyone can send a drone out. In fact, I'm the only one authorized. Other people are allowed to send them, but it's supposed to be cleared with me. Daphne's fingers were tap-dancing on her keyboard, bringing up more and more information on the suspicious robot. What kind of drone was this? I asked. Where did it go?
And when did it go out? Kira added.
It was a rover, Daphne replied. It went to Solar Array 2, Panel 36B, and it went out at 5:15 in the morning.
Who sent it? Roddy asked.
Daphne stopped typing and stared at the computer, shocked.
According to this, I did. But I didn't, which means someone here swiped my command code.
I stepped back from the office, not wanting her to see my face, afraid I couldn't control my excitement, because I had a very good idea who'd sent the probe out. Dr. Ronald Holtz.
Excerpt from the Official Residence Guide to Moonbase Alpha. Copyright 2040 by National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The Lunar Surface. The surface of the moon is deceptive. While it is certainly an amazing, beautiful, and serene place, it is also the harshest environment humankind has ever lived in. In direct sunlight, the temperature is 260 degrees Fahrenheit. And yet, the moment the sun goes down, the temperature will almost immediately drop to 240 degrees below zero. Cold enough to instantly freeze a man to death. In addition, there is no oxygen. Of course, your personal spacesuit can protect you against all this, temporarily. But keep in mind that should your suit not be put on properly, the lunar surface can kill within seconds. For this reason, access to the lunar surface is extremely restricted. Children are prohibited from venturing outside MBA unless an emergency has compromised the safety of the base. As for adults, unless you have express permission from NASA and the base commander, you should never venture onto the lunar surface. And even if you believe you have good reason to go, analyze your options carefully. If your task can be performed by a robot rather than a human, send the robot. And if you absolutely must venture onto the surface, never ever go by yourself. Always go with a partner. Check your suits multiple times before passing through the airlock. Don't wander too far from MBA, and exercise extreme caution. Let's not spoil our beautiful moon by having a tragic accident on its surface.
Chapter 17. Moonwalk. Lunar Day 189. Evening. The way I figured it, Dr. Holtz had sent the robot out to hide his phone somewhere around panel 36B in Solar Array 2. After all, the robot was dispatched shortly before Dr. Holtz stepped through the airlock. Who else besides him, except whoever had forced him to go outside, would have been awake at that time? And it was the perfect place to hide something. If Dr. Holtz's killer suspected he'd hidden evidence somewhere, they'd most likely search the base, but not outside it. When I explained my theory to Kira later, she admitted that not only did it make sense, but she'd been thinking the same thing. There was only one problem. Getting the phone wouldn't be easy. The surface of the moon is deadly. Therefore, Kira and I, as well as every other kid on base, were banned from going out onto it. Despite this, Kira was still eager to go.
It was amazing out there yesterday, she told me.
This was an hour after we'd confronted Daphne. The memorial was over. Everyone else's speech about Dr. Holtz had been much shorter than Nina's. Mom's had been the most touching by far. Now Kira and I were huddled in a corner of the staging area while most everyone else mingled in the rec room. Kira asked, "Didn't you think it was incredible when you were on the surface?"
"Of course," I replied, although the truth was, since it had been 6 months since I'd trudged from the rocket to the airlock, my memory of it had faded greatly. After all, the walk had only taken a few minutes, and there had been lots of distractions.
"So let's go," Kira said. "It won't take more than 10 minutes to get to the solar array."
"This isn't like sneaking behind the scenes at the art museum or the zoo," I warned. "This is dangerous."
"Not if we're careful. It's perfectly safe out there with our suits on."
"Dr. Holtz just died out there with his suit on."
"Because someone forced him to go out with it on wrong. Someone who's still on the loose here in the base, because the evidence against them is out there.
Kira pointed out the airlock in the direction of Solar Array 2.
That's only a guess, I said. Well, it's a good guess.
Kira gave me a frustrated stare.
I can't believe you're trying to weasel out of this. I thought you were going stir-crazy in this place.
I am.
So? Think how awesome it would be to get outside again, even for just a few minutes. There's no good reason we're not allowed out there. It's just a stupid rule that ought to be broken.
It's not stupid, I protested. And if we break it, we're going to get caught. We'll end up in big trouble.
Not if we find Dr. Holtz's phone, Kira argued. We'll be heroes.
I sighed and looked out through the airlock window. Kira was right. I did want to go out there again, and I didn't want to wait another 2 years and 6 months until my return rocket home to do it. But it was far more dangerous than Kira seemed to understand, or she was far more reckless than I'd realized.
There might be another way to get the phone, I said.
You mean like sending a robot? Kira asked. No, I don't know how to do that, and we can't ask Daphne to help. I looked down the hall, to where Daphne was standing with my parents and Chang. Daphne had already revealed her secret to everyone. As she'd promised, she'd told Nina right after the memorial, and word had spread quickly. Nina wasn't happy, of course, and told Daphne there'd be some punishment, but everyone else seemed okay about it. After all, Daphne was probably the most liked adult on the base. The fact that she'd owned up to her mistake and seemed genuinely ashamed only seemed to make everyone like her even more. My father and Chang were teasing her about it at the moment, humming the James Bond theme and calling her Special Agent Merritt.
Kira asked, "So what's the other option, then?"
"We get an adult to do it."
Kira looked annoyed. "Who? Your parents?"
"No," I said. "They wouldn't break the rules like that. And besides, they still think Dr. Holtz was crazy."
"Then who? We can't ask my dad. He'd get lost out there and we'd never see him again."
"I can't tell you." I knew Zan was the right person to approach about this. She was an adult and she was determined to find out who'd killed Dr. Holtz. She'd be thrilled to hear I'd learned where the phone was hidden, and she probably had all the security clearance she needed to go out onto the lunar surface. But she'd also made it extremely clear I couldn't tell anyone about our collaboration, no matter how much I wanted to.
"What are you talking about?" Kira demanded. "Don't you trust me?"
"Of course."
"Then why can't you tell me who you're going to?"
"I just can't," I said. Kira gave me a long, hot stare.
"Fine. Whatever. But if this secret friend of yours says no, then we go, okay?"
"They won't say no."
"But if they do, we go. Tonight. After everyone's gone to sleep, there's no time to waste. Whoever killed Dr. Holtz is going to find out about the robot soon enough."
"Sure," I said. "We'll go tonight."
"You promise?"
Kira stuck out her hand. I shook it.
"I promise."
I fully meant it. I just didn't think I'd have to. I never got to talk to Zan Profanik. I saw her. The first time she was standing with a bunch of scientists after the memorial service. The second time she was at dinner in the mess with the other temps. And both times she saw me, too. After the memorial, I signaled that I desperately needed to talk to her. She mouthed, "Not now," so I backed off, expecting her to come around sooner or later, but she didn't. So when we were in the mess, I decided to be a little more direct. I started across the room toward her, intending to approach her directly. When Zan saw me coming, though, she reacted with such alarm that I stopped dead. Behind the backs of everyone at the table, she shook her head wildly, panic in her eyes. I signaled again that we needed to talk.
"I know," Zan mouthed. "I'm sorry."
I started to signal that this was really, really urgent, but all the temps at her table were staring at me now like I was nuts. So I backed down and headed off to get dinner, hoping now that Zan knew I was desperate to talk to her, she'd come find me. But that didn't happen. This was incredibly frustrating. I'd found our biggest lead so far, and Zan couldn't make the time to hear it? I understood that we needed to keep our alliance a secret, but it seemed that secrecy was now jeopardizing the entire purpose of our investigation. I spent an hour trying to chill inside my residence after dinner, figuring Zan would swing by, and after that I went out and combed the base in search of her. I found everyone I didn't want to see, Nina, Dr. Marquez, the entire Sjoberg clan, but not Zan. After a dozen loops of the base, I had no choice but to conclude that she didn't want to be found. I couldn't wait for her anymore. Kira was right about there being no time to waste. If we had figured out that Dr. Holtz had sent the robot to the solar array, his killer would probably figure it out soon as well. And when they did, they'd go right for the evidence. I sent Kira a text. "We're on for tonight," she responded within seconds. 1 a.m. I reluctantly returned to my room and spent the rest of the evening trying to act normal around my family, hoping Zan would decide to throw caution to the wind and show up at our door. I talked to Riley in Hawaii for a bit, pretending everything was fine, then finally got around to making my video log about Dr. Holtz. I wasn't that pleased with it. It was kind of dull, just saying that Dr. Holtz was a nice man and that I'd miss him. But Mom and Dad both said it was perfect. I turned in when everyone else did, acting like I was tired when I was actually buzzing on adrenaline. I tried to read in bed but couldn't concentrate. Zan never showed. I slipped out of my residence at 1 a.m. on the nose. Kira was already in the staging area, pacing like a lion in the zoo. She brightened when she saw me. "I was worried you were going to chicken out," she whispered. "I'm right on time," I told her. She started to say something else, but I put a finger to my lips. The moon base was deathly silent at night. Even our softest whispers carried. Kira nodded understanding and opened the storage unit where the kids' spacesuits were kept. The suits had been custom-made for us solely so we could get from the rocket to the moon base and back. Each had cost millions of dollars for about 20 minutes of use. Or at least NASA hoped we'd only use them for 20 minutes, because the only other reason for them would be an emergency that required us to evacuate MBA, which is why the suit storage unit isn't locked. No one has ever told me what we are expected to do on the surface of the moon after all our air runs out. It seems to me that if something really went wrong at MBA, suiting up and evacuating to the lunar surface would only postpone our deaths. But maybe NASA figures that, at the very least, we'd be happy to go outside. MBA has mandatory practice emergency drills once a month to keep our evacuation routine well rehearsed. Due to this, I knew how to get my suit on quickly, even faster than Kira, who'd worn hers just the day before. In the early days of space travel, astronauts had to wear multiple layers of insulation, so suiting up could take several minutes. Nowadays, the suit itself is perfectly insulated, which means the person inside is much less constricted. I pulled on the outer shell, stepped into my boots, clamped my helmet, and pulled on my gloves in less than 2 minutes. Since we wouldn't be gone that long, I opted not to wear the astronaut diaper, which was designed so that anyone who asked to be on the lunar surface for a good stretch of time won't have to return to the base to use the bathroom. Then I sealed all the connections and checked them again, and again, and again. Then I had Kira do it for me. I had no intention of being the second person in history to die on the moon. I inspected Kira and found she was suited properly as well. Since my suit had barely been worn, it still smelled like a new car on the inside. I flipped on the fan vent so the glass of my helmet wouldn't fog up. Given our position at the pole, the sun was still out, even now, so we both lowered the reflective visors. Without them, in the sun's direct heat, undimmed by any sort of atmosphere, our heads would cook like potatoes in an oven. There were radios inside the helmets, so we could now talk to each other without the whole base hearing us. "Testing, testing," Kira said. It sounded like she was right next to me, speaking directly into my ear. "Can you hear me?" "Yes," I replied. "Can you hear me?" "Perfectly. Let's go." Kira clapped her hands in anticipation. We headed for the airlock. Normally, a security door is controlled by a thumb or retina sensor, so only certain people can open it. However, neither of those work very well when you're wearing space gloves and helmets, so this one has a large keypad instead. As kids, we weren't supposed to know the 6-digit code that would open the airlock, but my parents had taught it to me months before, figuring I might need it in case of an emergency, and that they could trust me not to do anything stupid like head outside without their permission. In truth, I figured that while heading onto the lunar surface was reckless, it wasn't insanely risky. Solar Array 2 wasn't far from the airlock, and I wasn't going solo. If all went well, Kira and I would only be outside 10 minutes, if that. I tapped in the code. The inner door of the airlock slid open. Kira and I stepped inside and entered the same code on another keypad. The inner door slid closed. There was a whoosh as the airlock repressurized to match the atmosphere of the lunar surface. I looked at Kira. Even though she'd been outside only the day before, she was bouncing up and down on her toes in anticipation. While I couldn't see her face behind the reflective visor, she didn't seem to have the slightest bit of concern about what we were doing. I couldn't help thinking of Riley's dog back on Earth, pacing at her kitchen door, barely able to wait to get out in the yard. Kira turned to me impatiently.
Come on, what are we waiting for?
I entered the code again on the keypad for the outer door. It slid open. Kira immediately bounded onto the lunar surface. I followed her. For some reason, I'd been thinking that after being cooped up inside for 6 months, it would physically feel strange to be outside. But it didn't. The suit increased my weight, so I didn't bound as far with each step. But other than that, I felt exactly the same as I had inside the moon base. But mentally, it felt very different. Like I was an inmate paroled from jail, or a zoo animal released into the wild. A sense of euphoria quickly came over me. Kira was certainly experiencing it too, behaving even more enthusiastically. With the added weight of her suit, she seemed more comfortable in low gravity and quickly bounded ahead of me, springing as high as she could with each step, whooping with joy.
"This is so awesome," she cried. "Can you believe it? We're on the moon!"
I took a few more steps. With each one, a puff of white moon dust exploded below my boot. It was like walking across a massive plain of pancake mix. Since there was no atmosphere outside, there was no sound from the surface, no crunch of my boots in the dust, though I probably wouldn't have heard it anyhow given Kira's thrilled exclamations ringing in my helmet. Several well-trod paths snaked through the moon dust from the airlock. The one we wanted veered right, then branched into two others. One of these went directly to the large white dome of the Moon Rover garage, while ours continued straight, threading the gap between MBA and the garage, then banked left to circumvent the science pod. As I took the turn, the robot arm came into view. I'd never seen it up close before. It was an impressive piece of machinery, an intricate combination of gleaming metal, pistons, and wires. Each of the three sections of the arm was more than 3 stories tall. They were connected with enormous ball and socket joints and folded up vertically, like the pincer of a massive praying mantis. The arm was attached to the lunar surface with a swivel, which allowed it to rotate 360 degrees and reach anything between the launch pad and the airlock. The hand was high above me, all 4 fingers and both thumbs clenched together in a gigantic fist.
"Dash, what are you doing?"
Kira's words caught me by surprise. I spun to find her well ahead of me, looking back my way.
"Sorry," I said, "I got distracted." "I'll say," Kira teased. "Hey, check this out."
With that, she leaped ahead, covering 20 feet with one bound. Then she crash-landed, tumbling onto her back. But she didn't seem to care. Instead, she lay there, giggling, and made the lunar version of a snow angel. Her enthusiasm was infectious. Even though our mission was serious, there was no reason I couldn't enjoy myself a bit. I cocked my legs and launched myself forward. The ground dropped away below me, and I sailed well past the robot arm, almost to the end of the science pod, and landed in a great cloud of moon dust.
"There you go," Kira cheered. "Wow, you practically went into orbit."
With that, she got back to her feet and bounded off again. I followed her. Springing across the lunar surface was more fun than I'd had in months. Exploring a real place was far better than any simulation the computers could cook up. Above us, the stars gleamed, and the Milky Way was a gorgeous slash across the ink-dark sky. The Earth shone brightly in the middle of it, a beautiful blue jewel. I found a patch of moon dust that had somehow remained pristine and unable to resist, planted my feet right in it, making myself the first human to ever set foot on that spot. The fun was short-lived, however. We were covering so much ground with each leap that we quickly reached Solar Array 2. Since it's on the western side of MBA, where there are no windows, I had never seen it before. It was startlingly large, a field of solar panels taking up significantly more space than the base itself. Each panel was 5 feet square, perched atop a tall metal post from which it could be angled directly at the sun. Currently, the panels were all tilted southwest, sucking up so much solar energy that I could feel the heat from them as we came close.
"Daphne said the robot traveled to panel 36B, Kira said. "Any idea where that is?"
I looked over the array. There were more than 1,000 panels. Thankfully, they were arranged in an orderly fashion, in perfectly spaced rows, like plants on a farm. I bounded to the closest support post. There was a number etched into the side, 29A. 28A was to my right. 30A was to my left. "This way," I said, heading left, where the row of panels continued toward the edge of the blast wall that surrounded the launch pad. I returned to walking normally now, not wanting to accidentally bounce up into the solar panels and fricassee myself. As expected, 36A was six panels down from 30A, and one row in sat 36B. I glanced at the moon dust at the base of its post. It had been trampled by hundreds of footsteps over the months of installation and maintenance, but a more recent non-human track, two sets of treads, sliced across all the boot prints. "Look," I told Kira.
"Dr. Holtz's robot," she said.
Even with her reflective visor down, I could tell she was smiling. "Looks like we're in the right place." I circled the post, looking for where the robot had set the phone. Only the phone wasn't there.
"I don't see anything," Kira now sounded concerned.
"Maybe it blew away," I said.
"A whole phone? How? There's no wind here, Brainiac."
"I know, but maybe when the rocket landed, the blast blew it somewhere." Kira's helmet shifted back and forth as she shook her head.
"No way. The blast wall is built to prevent that. Otherwise, the rockets would blow moon dust all over the solar panels and mess them up."
I frowned, not feeling quite so super anymore.
We'd been so sure Dr. Holtz had sent the robot out, but now I wondered if we'd made a mistake.
I scanned the area around post 36B, hoping to find some sign that we hadn't.
"Dash," Kira said, "there's something I have to tell you. Before we came out here tonight, I had a lot of time to kill, so I figured I'd search the computer files a little bit more." My gaze fell on the tracks of the robot in the dust. Something struck me as significant about them. Although I knew Kira was trying to tell me something important, I couldn't help but focus on the tracks, too.
"I decided to look for the footage from the bathroom the night you overheard Dr. Holtz in there," Kira went on. "Not to see you on the toilet or anything, I promise. Since the phone log had been erased, I was thinking that maybe if I could watch Dr. Holtz on the call, I could get some idea who he was talking to."
The tracks were from a small robot, I realized. That ruled out the maintenance ones, which tended to be quite large, as they often had to move heavy machinery.
It was probably a small probe, which the scientists used more often, mostly to take geologic samples.
Which meant it was built to dig. I dropped to my knees and began brushing moon dust away from the base of the post for panel 36B. Kira stopped talking. She dropped to her knees and started digging as well.
"Go on," I told her. "Never mind," she said. "It might not be important."
I brushed aside another scoop of dust, and something gleamed in the hole. I plunged my hand inside. It was hard to grasp anything with the gloves, but I finally managed to do it. A small, clear plastic bag had been buried in the hole. The kind of bag the scientists used to keep sterile samples in. Dr. Holtz's phone was inside it.
"You found it!" Kira cheered. "All right!"
She raised her hand for a celebratory high five. I gave it to her, but even though I'd found the phone, I didn't feel nearly as thrilled as I should have. Kira's voice had sounded far more relieved than excited, like there was something she knew that I didn't.
"What did you find on the computer?" I asked.
"Nothing."
Kira stood up and started walking.
"Forget I mentioned it. We need to get back to the base."
I stood too, but I didn't follow her.
"Tell me."
Kira turned back.
"No, I shouldn't have even brought it up. I was rushing to look through stuff, so maybe I misunderstood what I saw."
"Which was?" Kira motioned for me to follow her.
"Come on. We've been out too long as it is."
I stayed put.
"What did you see, Kira?"
She sighed heavily. In the speaker of my helmet, it sounded like a hurricane in my ears.
"Okay, I'll tell you. But you have to realize I might not be right about this. I wasn't even sure if I should mention it or not until I had time to go over everything again. But then we got here, and it looked like Dr. Holtz hadn't hidden his phone here after all. So I started to think that maybe he was cracking up a bit."
"Why would you think that?"
"Because I found the footage from the bathroom." Kira came back toward me. "The footage of Dr. Holtz's conversation. The reason we couldn't find any record of his phone call in the logs was that he didn't make a phone call."
"That's not possible," I said. "I heard him."
"You heard him talking to someone," Kira corrected. "But he wasn't using his phone. I saw him."
"You mean someone else was in the bathroom with us?"
"No, I could see the entire room in the footage. There wasn't anyone else there."
I stared at Kira, wishing I could see her face rather than just a reflection of myself in her visor.
"So he was just talking to himself? Like a crazy person?"
Kira's helmet nodded up and down. I wanted to defend Dr. Holtz, to tell Kira that she certainly had to be wrong, but before I could, I spotted something in her visor's reflection. Something else was moving on the lunar surface behind me, and it was moving fast.
"Look out!"
I screamed, then dove. I slammed into Kira, knocking her flat. A second later, the massive hand of the robot arm crashed to the ground where we had just been. It came in with such speed that it sliced clean through the support post of solar panel 36A and landed hard enough to make the ground shake. The panel toppled and shattered, strewing glass all over the lunar surface.
"What was that?" Kira gasped. "A malfunction?"
"No," I told her. "Someone's trying to kill us." As if to prove me right, the robot arm reared up again, preparing for another attack.
Excerpt from the Official Residence Guide to Moonbase Alpha, copyright 2040 by National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Emergency Preparedness. Although every precaution has been taken to make sure that MBA is as safe as any place on Earth, if not safer, given the nature of the base's location on the moon, there is always the chance that an emergency might occur. Rest assured that MBA is equipped to withstand anything the solar system can dish out, be it a fire, solar flare, or meteor strike. However, in the unlikely event of an emergency, your safety will depend on your being prepared. So remember the three FAR steps. 1. Familiarize yourself with all emergency systems and know how to use them. 2. Attend all monthly emergency preparedness sessions and evacuation drills. 3. Rehearse emergency procedures on a weekly basis, if not more often. Familiarize, attend, rehearse. F-A-R. It's easy. Actual emergency procedures and evacuation plans may not be easy for young children. All parents need to be prepared to handle their children's safety during emergencies.
Chapter 18. Bad Robot. Lunar Day 190. Possibly the last minutes of my life.
Run!
I ordered Kira. At the exact same moment, she yelled at me to do the same thing. Her scream echoed so loudly in my helmet that my ears rang. Meanwhile, the robot arm was bizarrely silent as it rose above us. It was kind of like watching an action movie with the sound off, only I was in it. The arm stretched to its full 100 feet, and the hand made a fist the size of a small car, which then swung down toward us. Kira and I were already moving. In our fear, we hadn't thought to coordinate. Each of us went a different way. I bolted back the way we'd come, while Kira plunged deeper into the forest of solar panels. The robot fist thudded down right where we'd been, shattering several more solar panels. Glass exploded into the air and sailed far and wide in the low gravity, the shards sparkling in the sunlight as they rained down around me.
"Where are you going?"
Kira screamed at me.
"Back to the airlock," I yelled. "Where are you going?"
"Where there's cover. You're right out in the open."
She was right. There was nowhere for me to hide on the route to the airlock, and the robot could reach me anywhere on the way. I'd planned on outrunning it, but I'd forgotten something very important. It's very hard to run on the surface of the moon. I could only bound along like I was in slow motion. It was like one of those nightmares where someone's coming after you, and no matter how hard you try to run, you can't. Only it was real. And now that I'd made the decision, there was no way to double back. The robot arm reared up again between me and the solar panels, its giant fist blotting out the sun. It was only about 50 yards from the solar array to the airlock, but despite my best attempts to run, I'd only covered a third of the distance. On Earth, the sound of the robot arm would have told me where it was, and whether it was going for me or Kira. On the stupid, soundless moon, I had to watch it, and with a spacesuit on, I couldn't just glance back over my shoulder. I had to turn my whole body, which wasn't exactly conducive to speed either. Behind me, the arm pivoted downward. It was coming for me, not Kira. I suddenly wished I'd worn that space diaper, though somehow, despite the fear of being pounded into paste, I managed not to evacuate my bladder.
"Look out!"
Kira cried. I couldn't outrun the giant fist. I had to try to dodge it. I watched as it arced downward, then sprang as it came in, using the low gravity to my advantage. This time, however, whoever was controlling the robot had changed their attack. Instead of simply trying to squash me flat, the hand suddenly extended its fingers and swooped in sideways. It was like being slapped by King Kong. One of the huge metal digits caught me flush in the chest, and I went flying. I tumbled through the air, soaring so high that I cleared the rover garage. For a moment, I feared I might actually break free of the moon's weak gravity and go into orbit. I found myself high enough to see the roof of MBA and the blinding panels of Solar Array 1 on the far side of the base. But then, thankfully, I began to arc downward again. Gravity yanked me back, and I face-planted on the lunar surface. In low gravity, you don't come down that fast, but I still landed hard. Every part of my body felt like it had been punched at once, and the wind was knocked out of me. I skidded across the surface, leaving a deep trough through the moon dust, until I slammed helmet first into a large rock, which stopped me dead. There was a soft, terrifying clink inside my helmet. I'd closed my eyes as I'd braced for impact. Now I opened them to have my worst fears confirmed. The glass of my helmet had cracked. A tiny web of fractures had appeared where I'd impacted the rock, looking like the divot a stone leaves in a windshield. But the cracks were spreading. My helmet wouldn't be able to take another hit. The glass would go, and I'd suffocate in seconds.
"Dash!" Kira's terrified voice rang inside my helmet. "Are you all right?"
I rolled over and took stock of where I was. The robot arm had knocked me 30 yards, so I was now on the opposite side of the airlock from where I'd started. The rover garage was between me and the field of solar panels. I could no longer see Kira over there. By the garage, the robot arm reared up on its pivot again. The hand swiveled back and forth, the palm angled at the ground. I realized it was looking for me. Whoever was controlling the robot had to watch me on the cameras, but the arm had swatted me so far I'd flown out of sight. There were several cameras mounted on the arm itself, though, and now my attacker was using them to scan the area to see where I'd landed. The airlock wasn't too far away now, only a bit more than 10 yards, temptingly close, but I didn't run for it. Instead, I stayed where I was, not moving an inch. The lunar surface was gray and white. My suit was gray and white, and now it had a layer of moon dust coating it. Hopefully I'd blend right into the surface. I wasn't going to disappear completely, like a chameleon changing color, but on the monitors, I'd be much harder to spot lying still than I would moving.
"Dash!" Kira screamed again. It sounded like she was crying. "Are you okay? Answer me!"
"I'm okay," I told her.
"Thank goodness! Where are you?"
"By the launch pad," I lied. The robot hand immediately swiveled that way, which meant the killer was eavesdropping on our transmissions. But I'd figured as much. And now I had diverted them and bought a few seconds. There was another clink from my helmet. A small crack extended from the impact point, spreading across the glass like the fissure of a miniature earthquake. I didn't have much time. I sprang to my feet and tried to run for the airlock.
"Hold on," Kira told me. "I'm coming to help you."
"No," I cried. "Stay where you are. Stay undercover. I'm fine. I'll send help for you." Of course, I couldn't run at all. I only bounded slowly, but the airlock came closer. And then I spotted something shimmering in the sun to my right. I turned that way and saw the bag with Dr. Holtz's phone lying in a patch of moon dust. I had tried my best to hold on to it as I had flown through the air, but it had obviously slipped from my gloved fingers, probably when I crash-landed. It now lay only a few feet out of my path. I tried to bank toward it and pick it up. Only it wasn't so easy in low gravity. On Earth, the detour would have taken only a few seconds, if that, but it was much harder to change direction on the moon. I skidded in the dust once I tried to stop my forward momentum, and again as I tried to grab the phone, squandering precious seconds each time. I plunged my hand into the moon dust, fumbling for the phone.
"Dash!"
Kira screamed. I risked a look back at the robot arm. It had spotted me and was on the attack again. It was hurtling my way, the palm open, only this time it was swooping around to nail me from the side. I figured that at the speed it was coming, one swat would send me sailing over the entire moon base like a home run ball. I'd land in Solar Array 1 and fry to death on the panels. I moved toward the airlock, but there was no way to outrun the arm. However, I only wanted whoever was controlling it to think I was trying to outrun it. I took one bound, then dug my heels into the lunar surface as hard as I could, bringing myself to a stop. The arm had extended, trying to catch me right by the airlock.
Now I sprang in the other direction, diving for the lunar surface again. The palm rocketed past my feet while the arm soared over me, close enough to clip the back of my helmet. The fingertips scraped the base hard enough to furrow the wall as they swept past. Whoever was controlling the arm tried to stop it, but now they had to fight the low-gravity inertia of the moon. They failed. The arm crashed into the rover garage. The crack spread farther across my helmet. I scrambled back to my feet, spun around, and lunged for the airlock. The arm had slammed into the garage so hard the wall had collapsed, and the arm was now tangled in the wreckage. It was jerking about, trying to wrest itself free. Pieces of the garage, and possibly the rovers, were tearing loose and flying away. I reached the airlock. There was no keypad on this side, only a big red button clearly marked open. There was no point making entry difficult from the outside, as there was no one else on the moon. I slammed my fist into the button. The airlock slid open. There was another red button beneath the first, in the event that the airlock was jammed. This one was marked Alarm. I punched it as well. The robot arm tore free from the garage, leaving a gaping hole. It then pivoted upward and suddenly froze. Whoever had been controlling it had abandoned the controls, probably frightened off by the alarm inside the base. I leaped into the airlock and punched the red button on the inside. The outer door slid shut. A moment later, the glass of my helmet shattered. I felt the staggering heat of the lunar surface and held my breath, hoping it wouldn't be my last. There was a blast of air as the airlock repressurized to match the atmosphere of the base. As it did, I could hear the alarm wailing through the inner door. The air was blessedly cool as well. "Are you all right?" Kira asked again. I tentatively inhaled. Oxygen filled my lungs. Even though this had happened 500 million times before, it was still the greatest feeling of my life. I sighed with relief. "I'm in the airlock," I told Kira, "and whoever was controlling the arm took off, so it's safe to come back now. Are you okay?"
"Yes. Just frightened. I've been hiding in the solar array the whole time. I'm sorry I didn't come help you."
"Don't be. There was nothing you could do."
"I guess not."
Kira still sounded guilty.
"Okay. I'm on my way back."
I pressed another red button, which opened the inner airlock door. Inside, the alarm was much louder, designed to ruin everyone's sleep and rouse them from bed. I glanced toward the robot control room. The door hung open. My attacker was long gone. Nina was already up and out her door, perched at the edge of the catwalk.
"You!" she yelled, glaring down at me. "What were you doing out there?"
"Just getting a little exercise." Nina stormed down the stairs toward me.
"You think that's funny? Well, it's not. This is a serious violation of protocol."
"Are we in trouble?" Kira asked through the radio. "Big trouble," I told her.
"Maybe I'll stay out here a bit longer," she replied.
Behind Nina on the catwalk, our door flew open. My parents emerged, panic in their eyes. I figured they'd woken to the alarm and discovered I was missing. Dad had Violet in his arms. She actually seemed pretty excited by all the noise. Mom and Dad spotted me at once, looked relieved and worried. They came down the stairs behind Nina, who was still chewing me out.
"Not leaving this base is the number one safety directive for every child here," she shouted. "What were you thinking? Or were you even thinking at all? And what happened to your helmet? Are you aware how lucky you were not to have died out there?"
"Yes," I told her. "I'm very aware of that." Nina reached the ground floor and stormed toward me, flushed red in anger.
"Then what possible reason did you have to go out there?"
"To get this." I held up Dr. Holtz's phone triumphantly. Only now that I had a moment to look at it, my sense of accomplishment quickly faded. Somewhere, during the robot's attacks, the phone had been hit too. The glass was shattered and the casing was cracked almost in half. The object I had just risked my life to get was destroyed.
Excerpt from the Official Residence Guide to Moonbase Alpha, copyright 2040 by National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Emergency preparedness continued. In the unlikely event of an emergency, it is imperative to respect the chain of command. The base commander has had far more training in emergency procedures than anyone else, has studied all possible crisis scenarios, and will be the primary liaison with mission control in the event of trouble. Therefore, in a state of emergency, any orders issued by the base commander must be followed immediately. Failure to do so will be considered mutinous behavior and will be punishable upon return to Earth.
should the base commander have been rendered unconscious, dead, or in any other way unable to carry out his or her duties, then the second-in-command will take over. Rest assured, though, that the chances of such an event occurring are exceedingly small. In all likelihood, your stay at MBA will be calm, relaxing, and trouble-free.
Chapter 19. Corrupted Evidence. Lunar Day 190. Really early in the morning. There may be no better way to cause chaos at a moon base than to set off the emergency alarm, rouse everyone from sleep, and then reveal that someone had just tried to kill you with a giant robotic arm. Nina was so apoplectic she didn't know what to get angry about first. Instead, she kept starting to yell about one thing, then changing her mind and yelling about something else. Within only 30 seconds, she freaked out about my irresponsibility, the wrecked rover garage, the shattered solar panels, how expensive the robot was, and how I had deliberately violated a direct order from her by pursuing my investigation. At no point did it ever occur to her to ask how I was doing after my near-death experience. However, my family was plenty concerned about me. My parents hugged me tightly and fawned over me, at once relieved to see that I was alive, annoyed that I'd done something so risky, and angry at Nina for how she was treating me. Violet's usual gleefulness had soured upon learning that I'd been in danger. She clung to me and cried while I tried to reassure her that the threat was over and everything was all right. Meanwhile, around us in the staging area, the Moonies were all going nuts. Lars Sjoberg was his standard jerkwad self, yelling at everyone within earshot about the alarm, as though this were merely another instance of bad service at MBA, like a hotel wake-up call that had come too early. Daphne was devastated by how her precious robot had been used for evil and severely damaged in the process. Some people, like Chang and Dr. Kim, were trying to make sense of what had happened, while others, like Roddy, were panicking and wanting to know if the alarm meant we had to evacuate the base. Even Dr. Howard was displaying emotion for the first time since he'd arrived. Once Kira returned through the airlock safely, he threw his arms around her and began sobbing. The only people who remained silent were Mr. Grissom, who was figuring out how to shut the alarm off, and Zan Perfonic, who hung back by the wall, studying everyone carefully and taking everything in. Eventually, I got the chance to tell my story, how I'd gone out to retrieve Dr. Holtz's phone and been attacked, but the attacker had fled before I could see who it was, and the phone was now a total loss. Chang took the phone from me and examined it closely. "Maybe not," he said. "Mind if I try to salvage something?" I wasn't sure I could trust Chang, but no one else volunteered to help. I glanced at Zan, and she nodded that she thought it was okay, so I handed over the evidence. Chang promised to stay within sight and went to work on it at the computer station in the control room. Meanwhile, Nina finally settled on one thing to be angry at. Me.
"Do you have any idea how much damage your reckless behavior has caused?" she demanded. "Millions of dollars, for sure. Maybe billions."
Mom placed herself between Nina and me, anger flaring in her eyes.
"Dashiell's behavior didn't cause any of this. Whoever was controlling that robot did. So why don't you stop chewing him out and try to find whoever just tried to kill him?"
"Because for all I know, your son made the whole thing up," Nina shot back.
"Oh, right," I said. "Kira and I decided to play with the robot arm, destroyed it by accident, and then went outside to fake our own deaths to cover it up."
"I wouldn't put it past you," Nina snarled at me.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," Dr. Howard yelled. "Give it a rest, Nina."
His words caught everyone by surprise, because few of us had even heard Dr. Howard speak, let alone raise his voice. Every last Mooney stopped what they were doing and turned his way. He was standing beside Kira now, still clutching her tightly, glaring at Nina.
"We all know you're afraid of a scandal here, but there is now irrefutable evidence that there is a killer on the loose at this base, so stop pretending that Dr. Holtz's death might have been an accident and face the facts."
It turns out, the second best way to cause chaos on a moon base is to reveal that one of the residents is a killer. Everyone who had finally calmed down now went nuts again. Moonies ran off to lock themselves in their rooms, or demanded Nina explain why she'd covered up the crime, or pointed accusing fingers at who they thought had done it.
"I'll bet it was Lars,"
Roddy announced, and half the other Moonies quickly agreed with him.
"This is an outrage," Lars shouted. "I am sick and tired of being treated like a common criminal." "This sounds like a job for Squirrel Force," Violet announced. "Silence," Nina roared. And when everyone kept talking, she added, "The next person I hear a peep out of gets thrown out the airlock."
Everyone shut up.
I have never covered anything up about Dr. Holtz's death, Nina informed us. Until now, all evidence has indicated that he died due to reckless behavior and personal error. And as of this moment, there is still no evidence that indicates otherwise. However, the Gibsons and Dr. Howard are correct. Someone on this base has caused some serious damage to our robotic arm and some of our facilities, most likely while Dashiell and Kira were on the lunar surface. Now, I intend to find whoever did this, and if their motives were, in fact, to bring harm to Dashiell and Kira, then I will see to it that they are prosecuted for what they have done. However, until that point, we are going to have order on this base. There will not be a witch hunt. So for everyone's safety, I'm sending you all back to your rooms right now until further notice. You mean you're grounding us all? Lars asked indignantly. I'm ordering you, Nina growled, as is my right as base commander, per the bylaws of Moonbase Alpha, Section 78, Subheading A. Anyone who sees fit to violate that order will be locked in the medical bay with Dr. Holtz's corpse and held there until I see fit. Is that understood?
Everyone nodded obediently and started back to their rooms. As my parents reluctantly turned away, Chang whispered from the control room, "Not so fast." He'd only wanted my family, the Howards and Nina, to hear. We all looked that way. "I found something," he said. "It's not much, and it's in bad shape, but I'm guessing it's what Dr. Holtz wanted us to see." Mom called to Dr. Brahmaputra Marquez.
"Alina, can you take Violet back to your room for a bit?"
"Sure," she replied.
"Are we having a slumber party?"
Violet asked, thrilled.
"Just for a little bit." Mom kissed Violet on the head and handed her off. Then she and Dad led me toward the control room. The Howards fell in beside us.
"Hold on now," Nina said. "I'm okay with the parents, but I don't think Dashiell and Kira need to be a part of this."
"I think they became a part of this when they nearly died getting the phone," Dad told her. "And frankly, I'm not about to let them out of my sight again with a killer on the loose. So why don't you just remove that stick from your rear end and let them see what they found?"
Nina steamed, but she didn't say another word. As we filed into the control room, I caught sight of Zan hanging back behind the other Moonies as they headed to their residences. She gave me a reassuring wink, and behind everyone's back, followed us to the control room. No one noticed her as she stopped outside the door, watching the proceedings inside. Instead, everyone was focused on Chang and the computer. He'd jury-rigged some wires to connect the phone to it.
"The phone is trashed," he told us. "We're talking terminally ill. The ports are wrecked, the wireless is blown, and most of the files bitted out there on the moon. However, between the computer and me, we've managed to salvage something. Given our time constraints, with there possibly being a killer on the loose and all, I only focused on the most recent items stored, figuring those would be the most relevant. Turns out, Holtz recorded a video only 30 minutes before he went out the airlock."
A murmur of excitement rippled through the room.
"Well," Nina demanded, "show it to us."
"I'm about to," Chang told her, "but it's pretty corrupted. I tried to clean it up as much as possible, but it's still in lousy shape, or at least the bit I've seen was. I didn't want to watch it all without you."
"Duly noted," Nina said. "Now run it."
"All right," Chang sighed. "You've been warned. Computer, play the footage."
"It would be my pleasure," the base computer replied.
A video sprang to life on the monitor before us. Only it didn't look much like a video at all. It looked like a great sea of static with an occasional image flashing for a split second. Not that any of the images seemed to matter. The few we could see were blurry or partially blocked, as though Dr. Holtz might have had the phone hidden somewhere, or perhaps cupped in the palm of his hand.
"I can't make out any of this," Nina griped.
"Doesn't matter," Chang told her. "What's important is the audio. I think Dr. Holtz only wanted us to hear this, not see it."
"Well, the audio's garbage, too," Nina muttered.
She was right. What we could hear pitched back and forth between garbled speech and a loud static buzz that sounded like a nest of giant hornets.
"Give it a moment," Chang told her. "It gets clearer."
No sooner had he said this than the audio improved, slightly. The voices were still terribly distorted, so it was impossible to recognize the speakers, but at least we could finally understand them. It began in mid-sentence. We'd missed the beginning of the conversation.
"Thought I might be seeing you this morning," someone said.
"That's Dr. Holtz," Chang told us.
"Oh?"
the other person asked.
"And why is that?"
Their distorted voice was several octaves too low. It made me think of what a rock might sound like if it were trying to speak.
"Who is that?" Mom asked.
Chang could only shrug in response.
"You might have fooled everyone else," Dr. Holtz said on the video, "but not me. I figured out what you were really here for shortly after we all got to the moon.
And what might that be?
The other person asked coyly. With the distortion, I couldn't even tell if it was a man or a woman.
To keep an eye on us all, Dr. Holt said. Not for NASA, though I suspect they were forced to give their approval. My money's on the military.
The other person laughed mockingly.
Dr. Holt, I think you're being a bit paranoid.
Really? You've obviously been watching me. Why else would you be talking to me at 5 o'clock this morning?
There was a brief pause. Then the other person said,
Touché.
So what's the purpose of this visit? Dr. Holtz asked.
It seems you've discovered something important.
Yes. Did you eavesdrop on my conversation in the bathroom this morning?
The other person ignored the question.
What is it that's so amazing?
Dr. Holtz hesitated for a moment, unsure whether to answer, but then his enthusiasm got the better of him. Even with his voice distorted, I could tell how excited he was. The news he'd been keeping inside just burst out.
I've identified an alien life form, he said.
I gasped in astonishment. Practically everyone else in the control room did too. My parents' faces lit up with excitement. Even the other person on the tape seemed caught by surprise. It was quite a while before they spoke again.
Confirmed?
Of course, Dr. Holtz replied. Many times over. The evidence is concrete.
Are we talking about microscopic life here? Unicellular? Some kind of bacteria or something?
No, Dr. Holtz's voice brimmed with excitement. A complex life form. An intelligent life form. In fact, a life form far more intelligent than we are.
Another wave of elation rippled through the control room. I was almost as amped on adrenaline from Dr. Holtz's news as I had been while fighting for my life. The only person who didn't seem excited was the other person on the video. Their voice barely modulated, as though Dr. Holtz had just told them something routine, such as, I like bagels.
How many of these extremely intelligent life forms have you encountered?
They asked.
Only one.
And have they made contact with any humans beside you?
Not that I'm aware of.
Why you?
I don't know, Dr. Holtz said.
There was another pause.
I think you do,
said the other person.
Don't lie to me, Ronald. This is extremely important.
I know it's extremely important, Dr. Holtz exclaimed. It might be the most important event in all human history. Actual contact with intelligent life from another planet.
What other planet?
Dr. Holtz didn't answer right away. Something about his visitor seemed to have put him on guard.
You'll find out soon enough, when everyone else does. I'm going to announce my findings on the base and to NASA this morning.
No,
the other person said menacingly.
You won't.
Beside me, Kira shivered. Her eyes were wide with fear. Dr. Holtz was taken aback, too.
What are you talking about?
Your announcement isn't going to happen. The people of the world aren't prepared for something like this.
Of course they are.
Dr. Holtz's voice sounded different now. I couldn't tell if he was angry or worried, though I would have bet on worried.
People have been hoping for a moment like this as long as there have been people.
No, they've been dreading it. Humans have never been prepared to meet the unfamiliar. Throughout our history, every time two cultures have encountered each other, it has resulted in war rather than peace. That's the root of all human conflict. Thousands of years of bloodshed. Us versus them. And that's just when people meet other people. People who are exactly like they are, save for the color of their skin, or the language they speak, or the god they worship. Can you imagine what would happen if humans learned that there really are other intelligent life forms out there? Ones who are smarter than us? Who know how to come to Earth? There'd be a worldwide panic.
I don't think that's true at all, Dr. Holtz replied. I think the people of Earth will be thrilled to hear the news.
That's not a risk I'm willing to take,
the other voice told him. With the distortion, it sounded extremely ominous.
Well, it's not your decision, Dr. Holtz said defiantly. It's mine. I'm revealing that I've made contact today, and there's nothing you can do to stop me.
Oh, there is, Dr. Holtz,
the other person said.
Believe me, there is. I have a lot of people at my disposal down on Earth, and at this very moment a team of them is positioned outside your daughter's home.
Dr. Holtz gasped. Even with the distortion, we could hear the fear in his voice.
You wouldn't dare.
The video suddenly ended. There was a burst of static, and that was it. Everyone turned to Chang. I could see shock and dismay on all their faces.
Where's the rest of it? Nina demanded.
I don't know, Chang said. Destroyed, I guess. We were lucky to get as much as we did.
Lucky? Nina snapped. We've got garbage. We can't even tell who confronted Dr. Holtz.
But we know someone confronted him, Mom said, and that to keep his discovery a secret, they forced him to go out the airlock.
We can't even tell if the killer's a man or a woman, Nina groused. And we don't know how they forced Dr. Holtz out.
They blackmailed him, Dad cried.
You heard them. They threatened his family. We don't know if that worked, Nina shot back.
It would work for me, Mom snapped, and Dr. Holtz is dead. What else do you need?
Guys, Chang said, I know we're all freaked out by the murder and everything, but Dr. Holtz said he made alien contact. This is huge.
We don't have any proof of that, Nina said curtly. Only Dr. Holtz's say-so, and as we're all aware, he might have been going insane.
Dad glared at her. I think the fact that we have a murderer on tape proves that Dr. Holtz didn't wander out the airlock by accident.
But it doesn't prove he wasn't crazy, Nina countered. He could have merely imagined this alien contact and the killer mistakenly believed him. But then we can't question the killer because we have no idea who they are.
Check the security feeds, Kira suggested. Whoever was controlling the robot arm would be on them. Nina shook her head.
Whoever it was shut down the security system before coming after you. All the recordings from tonight were stopped hours ago.
She pointed toward the computer.
That recording was the best lead we had.
My mind was racing. Despite Nina's argument, I still believed Dr. Holtz's story of alien contact. But the thrill of that had already been dulled by the frustration and anger. I couldn't believe that the recording I had worked so hard to get had failed to identify the killer. And yet it seemed to me that I was missing something. There was a clue I had overlooked somewhere during the last few days.
It's not like the killer can get away, Dad pointed out. It's someone on this base. We simply have to question everyone about the events. I'm sure the killer will slip up somehow. Not necessarily, Nina sighed. We could go through the whole dog and pony show and end up right back where we are now.
Well, we have to do something, Dr. Howard exclaimed. This person didn't only kill Dr. Holtz, they nearly killed two children. And if we don't find them soon, what's to say they won't try to kill again?
Mom turned to Chang. Isn't there some way you can get some other data from the recording?
I've done my best, Chang said. I'm only a genius, not a miracle worker.
I wondered if Chang was telling the truth. Maybe he was the killer, and he hadn't tried to clean up the recording at all. Or maybe the recording had been fine, and he'd done the damage himself, covering up his own presence on it.
Please, Mom said, can't you try?
Chang sighed and turned back to the monitor.
Computer, is there any way to clean up this recording?
Perhaps, the computer replied. What would you like me to lean it up against?
Not lean it up, you stupid machine, Chang snapped. Clean it up! Can you clean it up more?
I'm sorry, the computer said. The recording is in very bad shape. I'm afraid this is the best that can be done.
Everyone sagged, looking defeated. Except me. I just realized something important. Computers could make mistakes. Despite all the amazing things they were capable of, they were still fallible. The base computer misunderstood and misinterpreted things all the time. The problem was, we tended to forget this. We tended to think the computers were perfect and trust them completely. I had done exactly that the day before. I had trusted the computer when I shouldn't have. I think I know who killed Dr. Holtz, I said.
Excerpt from the Official Residence Guide to Moonbase Alpha, copyright 2040 by National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Computers.
For your convenience, MBA has been designed with the latest state-of-the-art computer technology. The base computer can handle many of your day-to-day needs, ranging from establishing comlinks with Earth to analyzing lunar soil samples. And since it is equipped with the latest voice recognition software, all you have to do is ask it. The computer is always listening, everywhere, all the time. So whenever, or wherever, you need help, it will be there for you.
As of the time of construction, computer technology will most likely have advanced by the time you read this manual.
Chapter 20. Irrational Fear. Lunar Day 190. Really early in the morning. Everyone turned to me at once.
Who? They demanded.
Well, I hedged. I'm not 100% sure.
Great, Nina muttered.
But there's a way to check it out, I finished quickly. You see, Dr. Holtz tried to name his killer the other night, only we didn't understand what he was saying.
Everyone asked questions at the same time. When? Why? How do you know?
Hold on, Dad told them all.
Give Dashiell time to explain himself. He then looked to me expectantly, as eager to hear my thoughts as everyone else. I suddenly found myself very nervous, wondering if I was right, but I pressed on anyhow. Kira found footage of Dr. Holtz inside the airlock, right before he went out onto the moon,